This program is designed to provide general information with regards to the subject matters covered. This information is given with the understanding that neither the hosts, guests, sponsors, or station are engaged in rendering any specific and personal medical, financial, legal, counseling, professional service, or any advice. You should seek the services of competent professionals before applying or trying any suggested ideas.
Welcome to Woodbury Reports with your host, Lon Woodbury, talking with leading professionals about how parents and others can help their struggling teens, preteens, and young adults. Now here's your host, Lon Woodbury.
Welcome back to the Woodbury Report. I'm Lon Woodbury, located in North Idaho, and with me today I have Liz McGee. Hi, Liz.
Hi, Lon.
How you doing? How's everything in Denver? Any forest fires or anything?
Everything seems to be pretty good right now. It's a pretty day, and we've had some good weather, so yeah, everything seems to be fine. How's Idaho?
We've had that, but it's here in North Idaho, but thunderstorm coming in, a little bit of rain, so a little bit of variety. It was getting up in the 90s, and that's hot for us.
That's a good thing. Didn't you guys had some forest fires, didn't you, for a while?
Oh, that's south of us. We just get the smoke coming in from all directions. Actually, okay. We didn't get into high fire danger until a couple, 3 weeks ago. It was moderate here.
Oh, wow.
First part of the month. So we've been real lucky here on that. Well, okay. Back to the show. Here's where we talk to knowledgeable people about all things involved with struggling young people and the program to try to help them. And we're going to do something different, a different format this time. And we're going to talk about the news, and particularly news and events from around the network of residential programs for struggling teens, the private and parent choice ones. And what we'll do is we'll talk about the issue, then listen to a short interview, and then talk about it. And hopefully we can get some light on this. First one, we're going to talk about the Wilderness Symposium and listen to Gil Hallows. So, Liz, you've attended some of these Wilderness Symposiums. It's coming up at the end of this month. It's I've heard nothing but good things about them from the Wilderness. So what's your impressions?
You know, I haven't attended the last 2 years, but I attended the ones prior to that. And they were mostly in Boulder, Colorado. And I think this year it's going to be in Park City, Utah. And
yeah.
The general feeling that I had when I was there was that this was a really excited group of people and really kind of exploring how therapeutic wilderness programs can be. But I think that the thing that was so incredible about the conference was the fact that you really see how much wilderness programming has evolved and gone from being what was seen as, you know, a couple of kids that were having some troubles walking around in the woods and roughing it to really making it a very strong therapeutic tool, not just for teenagers, but for young kids too. They have programs that go down to age 10 and for young adults and adults too, even those struggling with addictions. I know that our first clip, Gil Hallows, he has a wonderful program for adults, young adults and adults struggling with addiction in Utah, and it is an outdoor program as well. So, yeah, I really think that it's a great conference.
You know, one of the things you talked about, evolution, I remember when I first started working in this business at a therapeutic boarding school in the mid-1980s, the tendency then was to, and some people I talked to, that what they did is they give them a bunch of kids, they say goodbye and head off in the wilderness. This is in southern Idaho into the River of No Return area. And they'd say, see you in 30 days. And with no communications, they're just pretty much on their own. And then it evolved into more survival. And Seuss was ones down in South Idaho that pioneered that. And then it was more better communication, better contact, but it was more of a survival. Like I would talk to kids that had gone to those, and this was in the 80s, and they'd say, I was the best rattlesnake catcher, because if they caught the food, they could supplement their diet, you know, if I had caught the food. And then it's evolved, and what you see here, now what I've heard is, they have up to six-hour workshops. You can have an exercise in learning to meditate in the desert, or a demonstration on building a flute out of materials you'll find around a campsite, or how to build a fire by a bowl drill. So there's a lot of program stuff there, as well as more program types of things.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the other thing that is really interesting, it's not just the how-tos of what to do with the kids, but it also gets focused on safety. Obviously, outdoor programs have to really be careful, and they look a lot at safety. It actually looks a lot at what are we doing that are, you know, research-based, evidence-based practices. And so it's really a conference that brings together people from all areas, and that's the other piece. It's not just the people that run the programs, it's field staff, it's people that are just generally interested in it, in the field of outdoor programming. So, you know, it is a conference, I think, that if anybody has the slightest bit of interest in wilderness programs, it really could provide you with some good information, regardless of your level of interest.
Yeah, and a good way to network with people working in the field on that. Mm-hmm. Well, let's listen to our first tape. The interview with Gil Hallows goes about 10 minutes where he talks about it. And Gil is the chairman of the event. And as you said, he runs a marvelous little program there in Utah. But he talked about the upcoming Wilderness Symposium, what they're trying to do, and things like that. So let's hear what Gil has to say, and then we can talk about it. Welcome back to the Woodbury Report. This is Lon Woodbury. It's July 16th, 2014, and I'm talking with Gil Hallows. Now, Gil is the executive director of Legacy Outdoor Adventures in Utah, but he's also the chairperson for the Wilderness Symposium that'll be coming up later on. It's an annual event. So, Gil, could you welcome first? Glad to have you here.
Well, thanks, Lon, and thanks for this opportunity to talk a little bit about the upcoming symposium.
Okay, well, just what's this all about?
Well, let me start by saying the Wilderness Therapy Symposium started 10 or 11 years ago. Rob Meltzer and Naropa University collaborated in starting the symposium. Here several years ago, the Outdoor Behavioral Health Care Council had the opportunity to take on the symposium. This will be our third year that the OBH Council has put on the symposium. The last 2 years, we've kept it in Boulder. And this year, for the first time, we're moving it to Park City, Utah.
So just who is this for, and then what will they be doing?
The symposium brings together a wide range of people with a wide range of interests that have in common the interest in using the wilderness as a healing tool. The primary representation at the symposium will be wilderness therapy programs from across the country. But also included will be a whole range of referring professionals, therapists, academicians, those who run programs that are devoted to offering rites of passage experiences. So the whole spectrum of people who have an interest in wilderness therapy, broadly defined. And pertaining to the wilderness therapy programs that will send people to the symposium, there is a particularly large representation from field guides, field staff, those who are working on the ground directly with clients in wilderness therapy, which sets the symposium apart as somewhat unique among all of the conferences that are available for people to attend.
So this is a sort of situation a person could come networking. I'm sure it's very good for networking and learn some wilderness skills. Aren't there some workshops on various things? Anything from maybe doing creating a fire by a bow drill to the philosophy of it. What all are some of the workshops are going to be having?
There, there's a whole range of workshops, and they're 1.5 hour, 3 hour, and 6 hour length workshops. The workshops cover the whole spectrum of topics pertaining to wilderness therapy, all the way from reporting on research. There will be a heavy research component, including a full day of the pre-symposium. One of the pre-symposium workshops will be a full day devoted to research. There will be a number of experiential workshops, some that are off-site and are a full 6 hours. Many are right there on-site, 1.5 and 3 hours. So there will be something that will appeal to the interests of virtually everyone who has anything to do with wilderness therapy.
Well, I'm impressed. A six-hour workshop, that's serious. If somebody wants to get serious about learning new things, that should keep them satisfied.
Yes, and in fact, those are all very experiential. There are such things as making your own flute and learning how to use flute making therapeutically, rock climbing and how to make rock climbing a therapeutic experience are a couple of examples that spring to mind on the six-hour workshops.
Okay, you mentioned the research, heavy research. Could you spend a little bit of time and tell me what research is being done and what's either the Wilderness Symposium or OBHIC is involved with, and what have the results been showing?
Well, I will say that the Outdoor Behavioral Healthcare Council, it used to be called OBHIC, and we took the I out of the name a couple of years ago, so now we just call ourselves the OBH Council. Was founded in 1996, and one of the strong parts of the mission of the council is to, and always has been, to sponsor research, to generate outcome research, to help make the case that wilderness therapy is a viable treatment option, and in terms of cost effectiveness, is a cost-effective treatment option. We've been collecting data from a number of the member programs for the past 15, 16, 17 years, the amount of research being conducted has grown exponentially the past few years. For many years, Dr. Keith Russell headed up the research cooperative. A few years ago, that was passed on to Dr. Michael Gass at the University of New Hampshire. We have a team of seven, we call them research scientists, all of whom are doing research on some aspect of wilderness therapy and are publishing their results. All seven of these research scientists are PhD-level researchers and affiliated with a major research university. You can find all of their publications on the OBHRC website. It stands for the Outdoor Behavioral Healthcare Research Cooperative. And it's just a wealth of write-ups on the research that is being done in the field of wilderness therapy.
Okay, well, if somebody is interested in checking out the Wilderness Symposium or perhaps attending it, how would they find out more information, or who would they call, or what are the various ways somebody could find out about it?
Well, go to the OBHC or the OBHIC website, OBHIC. You can still find it through the OBHIC website. And there's a symposium link there that will take you right to the registration. Registration is open. There is an early bird discount through the end of July. There is also information on that Wilderness Therapy Symposium link on the hotel and how to book your rooms at the hotel. We're having the symposium this year in a place called The Canyons. It's a beautiful mountain resort near Park City, Utah. It's just 30 minutes from the Salt Lake City Airport up in the mountains. And it's at a beautiful resort. We have negotiated great room rates at this lodge. And so I would invite all who are interested to check out the website and come and experience the Wilderness Therapy Symposium.
Okay, and what are the dates?
The dates are August 28th through August 30th. The pre-symposium workshops are the Thursday the 28th. That evening we'll have a networking reception, a big group dinner, and then a keynote address. And I should put in a plug for the for this year's keynote is Richard Louvre, who has written the bestseller Last Child in the Woods. And many people will be familiar with the title of this book, Last Child in the Woods. The author, Richard Louvre, his view is that much of what ails modern-day society in terms of the problems that young people are encountering these days results from not enough exposure to nature. And
okay.
So he will be the keynote speaker on Thursday evening. Then all day Friday will be workshops with a big social event Friday evening right there on the Canyons Resort, kind of mid-mountain. There's a beautiful lodge we're having a reception in. And then the Saturday morning workshops will continue, and the symposium will end about midday Saturday, August 30th.
Well, it sounds great, and you've just about talked me into making it down there this time. I've been talking with Gil Hallows, the chairperson of the Wilderness Symposium that's coming up late in August in Park City, Utah. And this is Lon Woodbury with the Woodbury Report.
Well, we got a whole bunch of questions coming in on that. And the first one, can anybody attend these conferences? And yes, anybody that's interested. There is a reception, I think, on Thursday that's open to the public. And you don't have to register for it. Otherwise, you'd register for part of the conference. And can anybody who can go, anybody that's interested, but it's especially effective for professionals that work with kids that are having some problems and their parents.
Well, and you know, one of the things I think is really important to also know is that professionals can get continuing education units at this conference too. Social workers, marriage and family therapists, chemical dependency counselors, all of those professions have CEUs that are offered. So it's a good way to get CEUs and maybe learn about something that you're not necessarily familiar with. There are going to be a lot of people there that are familiar with the industry, but you know, I even would encourage if there are people that maybe are just graduating from college and would like to know what it would be like to work as a field staff in one of these programs. There's going to be a number of programs that are going to be exhibiting there, programs with a huge range of options for treating, you know, kids, young adults, and teenagers. And so, you know, really, if there is somebody who has a specific interest, whether it's chemical dependency treatment or maybe a program that focuses more on a camp or a base camp model and does some, there's a program in Hawaii that does something with sustainable growth and they do a lot of horticulture. You know, so really if there is any specific interest, I think you're going to be able to find it there depending upon what your profession is. At Legacy, the program that Gil Hallows runs, very well known for chemical dependency treatment. And a number of outdoor programs have really evolved into being very specialized in that area.
And now the next question here, that do you need special licenses and teaching to run these programs? Licenses, yes. If you're working with kids and working with the public, and especially if you're on public land, you need permits and should have licenses. If you're doing anything like this, if it's considered therapeutic or a healing type of thing, you might need a therapist with their licenses. But so far, to go to the conference, as Liz talked, you don't need to have any experience. This might be the beginning of it. And so far as the location, these are nationwide and actually some overseas. There's one I've been thinking seriously about going to visit that down in Puerto Rico. And there's been various types of programs with at least an wilderness element in Costa Rica and Samoa. There's a lot on the East Coast. Most of them are in the Northwest because that's where these type of programs, the short-term wilderness therapy programs, originated. Mm-hmm. But they're everywhere. They're in the Southwest. They're in some in the Southeast and Northeast.
I find it interesting how they've really evolved and become so clinically competent in terms of treatment. I think what used to be known 25 years ago as kind of a camping experience for difficult teenagers. I mean, now these are very sophisticated programs that have testing evaluations that can be done while the kids are there. Therapists that specialize in DBT or EMDR. There's a couple of programs that have some real specific focus in terms of one program up in Wisconsin, New Vision Wilderness, has a focus on trauma and attachment. So, I mean, really, there's so many more options out there, and they really have evolved into very clinically sophisticated and sound programs. And there's a big focus on safety, too. I know that a lot of times people have maybe heard some horror stories in the past, but I know that the programs associated, especially with OBHI or OBH, what do they call it now? OBHC. But they are very aware of safety and safety standards. So these are very competent and safe programs and successful for a lot of these young people.
There's a lot of research that's been done that's showing that they're effective. I'm not sure if they've gotten to the evidence-based programming status yet, but they're getting close to it. But there has been a lot of research showing that it is a very effective way to approach at least some of the children. And one of the things I wanted to say, Richard Louv, The Last Child in the Woods book, he coined sort of tongue-in-cheek nature deficit syndrome. Is what he was talking about, and that basically, as Gil said, I was talking about, we don't have enough experience with nature, and yet we evolved as a species living in nature, in amongst nature, and so it's just a deficit if we don't have the time out. And you think about it, how popular it is for the family to go out camping or go to the beach or get outdoors. That's a popular vacation thing, mm-hmm. and. Now, I think another question, then we'll go on to the next thing, is how do you know they run the programs legit or that the programs are legit? They have to be licensed by the state.
And each state is different in that area, too.
Yeah, each state is different. But there has to be a license by the state. They have to, unless they're in the South, some of the religious programs don't have to because they're Christian. But most of them, they have a state licensing. There's professional organizations, the NATSAP, the National Association of Therapeutic Schools and Programs, have membership. And so being a member of that is an indication that that they're accepted by their peers. I do a survey as part of my practice every year of what the independent educational consultant think, and we come up with the ones with the best reputations. And so there's a lot of ways. One thing very emphatically, I don't think there's a single boot camp in this whole symposium. Mm-hmm. Boot camps were tried back in the 80s. There were some deaths, and the private sector moved away from them. So almost all boot camps now are publicly done, and all the horror stories out of boot camps are publicly owned and run programs. The private sector has almost completely stayed away from them. So we're not talking about militarization. We're not talking about boot camp. We're talking about getting in touch with nature and building relationships with nature.
And I think it's also important that, parents do consider, sometimes I would consider using an educational consultant to help you find what the right fit is for your child. All of these programs have different offerings, and, consultants have had experiences with a number of them, with most of them. And I think that getting an experienced consultant who understands these programs and understands, your specific needs can hopefully find the right fit. That they can make sure that you're making the right decision to have the most impact.
Yeah, doing it alone and yourself is something like going to court, mm-hmm. and choosing a program. If a parent's looking for a program for their child, it's a little bit like going to court without an attorney. You mm-hmm. legally can do that, but it's not a good idea. Well,
exactly.
It works better if you get an educational consultant, knowledgeable with reputation. Well, let's move on to the next topic. We're going to talk about equine therapy and maybe a little bit broader animal therapy. That's become very popular the last several years. And basically, in equine therapy, horses are used as the therapist, but I've seen dog programs that have been very effective at therapeutically healing for kids. I've seen various other animals of a variety. I think one calves and sheep has been therapeutic. Well, let's talk about the equine therapy. And I think it was back in the late 80s I had my first experience with it down in it was Sierra Tucson down in Arizona. And it was really amazing what the horses would do, how the horses would react. They paired us up with the horses, and the horses chose us. And we liked the horse, and they didn't care for us. Tough. it was interesting. But a lot of people say the horse, in something like this, the horse is the therapist, because they're very intuitive and they are not deceptive. They're very honest and they pick up on your feelings. So if you approach a horse with fear, the horse will react to it. And the horse's reaction tells you, okay, you've got some fear you need to deal with.
Yeah, and I think what's been really interesting is in the last, in the last 25 years, it's the awareness about equine therapy has really developed, and understanding that it can really benefit all ages. And people don't necessarily have to have any inclination or background towards horses. I know a lot of kids that end up working with equine therapists have never even seen a horse before. They actually end up in some kind of therapeutic program that might have an equine program. So it's really not about any kind of pre-exposure to horses or anything like that. With an experienced therapist, it's amazing at some of the things that they can do and, you know, really what some of the kids end up accomplishing in the process.
You know, one of the things, images that we have from the past is breaking a horse, and that was the mentality when I was a kid. I had horses. I was raised on a small gentleman-type farm and had a horse and did a lot of riding of horses. And the idea was you broke a horse, you forced the horse to submit. And there's people that excelled in that, and that was the whole basis of the rodeo and stuff like that. That's evolved, and the Horse Whisperer, the movie, and has shown a real change in the attitude, and but I've seen some evidences where a person could stand in there and just by body language and very subtle body language, they could make the horse run around, come to them, back off, do all kinds of things, a tremendous amount of control. And so they're teaching the kids how to respond, and by interacting with the horse, developing a relationship with the horse, then the children begin to heal and they get a lot of self-insight. And then there's, of course, debriefing after that.
Absolutely.
So what we have is a clip by Lynn Thomas. Now, Lynn Thomas is the director of EGALA. EGALA is a well-known training association for equine therapy. And I think she says it's something like 140 different countries there's equine therapy programs. And this particular interview was for an up-and-coming training, I think later this month. Maybe it's already passed, but in North Carolina. And so equine therapy, and Lynn Thomas talks and explains about that.
This is Lon Woodbury, and welcome to Woodbury Report. It's July 3rd, 2014, and we have Lynn Thomas, the Executive Director of EGALA, on the phone. Well, glad you could take the time to visit with us, Lynn. Good afternoon.
Hello. Good afternoon.
Okay, well, you announced a workshop coming up for EGALA Associates. Now, EGALA, you're the leading, as I understand it, probably the leading organization for equine-assisted psychotherapy. Could you tell me a little bit about what EGALA exactly stands for, what the initials stand for? It's E-A-G-A-L-A. And then a little bit about what you're trying to do with it.
Yeah, it's the Equine Assisted Growth and Learning Association, and we're a nonprofit association for professionals using equine assisted psychotherapy. We were founded in 1999, and we are the largest professional organization internationally, specifically for using horses for mental health and human development. And so we now have over 4,500 members in 49 countries. And there are over 600 programs now using the EGALA model.
Oh, that's impressive. You've done a lot of good work the last few years.
Yes, it's been very exciting because it really has grown, and there's just such an interest in new ways of helping people change their lives, whether it be youth or adults, and it's been neat to see it take off internationally.
Yeah, well, you have a business development workshop coming up. That's August 29th through 31st in North Carolina. And what's the purpose of that, and how does a business development, is it basic business development, or is there some things unique to equine-assisted psychotherapy?
Well, it's somewhat basic business development, but we tailor it to primarily our members. It really could apply to any type of business. But, you know, with equine-assisted psychotherapy, it's a new modality, and it really involves a lot of entrepreneurial skills to get programs or private practices going involving it. And so basically, EGALA has a training and certification program to do equine-assisted psychotherapy, but then once you're certified and trained in that, it's kind of what are the next steps in developing a business with it. And so that's what this workshop is designed to help support, that process, and help people be successful with it. One of the things that makes this workshop unique, whether you're going to do EGALA programming or any other kind of business, is that we are using equine-assisted learning, the EGALA model equine-assisted learning, as part of the learning experience in the 3 days. So we cover a lot of different topics devoted to business development, strategic partnerships, and the internal team. And with that, though, you're able to do some self-discovery and exploration and learning through the horses, too, which makes it a bit more interesting and fun and somewhat, hopefully, insightful, too, for people.
Okay. Well, I understand you do regularly, year-round, you do EGALA certification. This is apparently one part of it, but you do it specifically on the EGALA system and how to work with horses and in providing therapy. Is that correct? How often do you have these various certification classes?
Well, the training and certification program requires taking 2 3-day courses, a part one and a part two. And we hold around 80 trainings a year around the world. So that's pretty ongoing, and people can find out about that on our website under events. This business development workshop is pretty unique, and it's a specialized workshop, you could say, and open to people who are certified or not certified to attend it. And we only hold a few of these a year, so it's kind of more of a specialized, unique experience for people.
Okay. Well, if somebody was interested, so one of our listeners is interested, how would they get a hold of you or find out more about it?
Yeah, they can go to our website, which is EGALA.org, or you're welcome to call our office at 801-754-0400.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, and good luck with your workshop and the rest of it. We've been talking with Lynn Thomas, Executive Director for the EGALA Association, and a workshop that they have coming in North Carolina late August.
Okay, so that tells a little bit more about what they're doing. It's become a very wide activity, and a lot of programs I know have some sort of equine therapy in it.
Well,
that's a supplement.
And it's actually being used so broadly to treat so many different types of issues. I mean, everything from PTSD to cerebral palsy, depression. They use equine therapy in addiction treatment programs, autism. It really has an ability to be effective for so many different in so many different areas. So it's nice to see that it's, you know, getting that recognition that it deserves. And, you know, I mean, I think there's a misconception when you say equine-assisted psychotherapy or equine therapy that, you know, people think that, you know, that always involves riding, and it doesn't. I mean, you talked about your experience, Lon, that really involved somehow working with the horse to achieve a certain task, but you may not even end up touching the horse during that whole process.
I don't think I got on and rode the horse in that case. I don't think I've ridden the horse in any of the demonstrations mm-hmm. that I've seen. It's being around. It's a reaction. It's a relationship. And I think one of the key things that why it's effective, one of the things it's effective is a lot of the kids, the struggling teens that we get in our programs, don't trust anybody. And they've learned not to trust anybody. But all kids, all people relate to animals. And the kids can trust a horse or an animal. I can trust a horse and learn to break through. And then that can be generalized back to trusting other relationships. I think that's a large part of it.
I think so, too. And yet there is a component of equine-assisted therapy that is called hippotherapy. And that is nothing to do with a hippopotamus. Hippotherapy.
Oh, good.
That is actually, it's more of a form of, I guess you could say, occupational type therapy and works with the actual movement of the horse to work with the sensory input of the child and help them with some, it really benefits kids with some neurological functioning deficits and sensory processing deficits. So there is that piece too. So, I mean, the uses of equine therapy are huge.
Oh, yeah. And I think a lot of other animals, like there's one that in Missouri, Kalo, that uses dogs in the therapy for attachment, reactive attachment.
We do at Sandhill Child Development Center, too. We do a lot of work. We have horses and dogs.
You still have goats down
there? We don't have the goats right now, but we're doing a lot of work with, the rescue dogs in the community and the kids interacting with the animals, because the reason why the interaction with the horses or the dogs is so effective is that our kids oftentimes will misperceive cues from people. They don't misperceive those cues from the animals. And so they're able to work with them and they're able to kind of test out certain things that they would have difficulty with other people. And so it really is very therapeutic, even to the point of just caring for and grooming the horses can be incredibly therapeutic for these kids.
Okay, well, we've got one comment here. Somebody wanting to see what the show is about, and I guess they're trying to sleep. But it's basically news around the network of private parent choice schools and programs for struggling teens and what's happening. And we talked, the first one was in the upcoming Wilderness Symposium. We just finished with equine therapy. And the next we're going to talk about research, because there's a question of, well, where can this place of research is? Mike Merchant, he's the current president of NATSAP, that's the National Association of Therapeutic Schools and Programs, and a new initiative they have of evidence-based programs, EBP. And that's become sort of almost a gold standard in the mental health industry, or broader than that, the scientific community, that if you run a program, there should be some evidence that it works. They don't want a lot of experimentation on that. And so he's going to now, this is a new initiative that NATSAP has done to encourage programs to use and to recognize programs that are effectively used of evidence-based programs. So let's hear what Mike Merchant has to say.
Welcome to the Woodbury Report. This is Lon Woodbury, located in North Idaho. And we're talking today with Mike Merchant. Mike is the president of the National Association of Therapeutic Schools and Programs. He's also the president of the Anasazi Foundation down in Arizona. So good morning, Mike. Glad to have you here.
Good morning, Lon. Good to be here.
Well, you guys started an initiative, the NATSAP did, on evidence-based programs and designating them in the NATSAP. So why don't you start a little bit, tell if people aren't familiar, just exactly what NATSAP is and what's it trying to do.
NATSAP, again, the National Association of Therapeutic Schools and Programs, is an association of almost 200 programs. These are private placement programs in several different models, everything from wilderness therapy to therapeutic boarding schools to residential treatment centers, working with adolescents and families and their families. And this association has been participating in a research initiative for some time, a research cooperative, and they've set up an association with the University of New Hampshire where programs can gather data and put it into a common database that researchers can then use to actually analyze the effectiveness and the work that we're doing, as well as look carefully at adolescent issues and trends out there for adolescents in treatment and care.
I think this is very intriguing because I know there's some critics of these private programs that say there's not an iota of proof that these programs work. And NASAP has been doing yeoman's work of providing that evidence and the research. And I think there have been very significant things found and a lot learned on that. So NASAP is trying to, is helping programs, and it's a network or association. But this evidence-based programs are called EBP initiative, to where you're planning, it looks like from the release, you're planning to designate certain programs that have shown that they are using evidence-based programming. Could you tell us a little bit more about that and the importance of it?
Yes. And what our hope was to actually step this up a little bit more. We have programs who are participating in the research initiative. We also have several programs, member programs, that are actually doing their own research initiatives. And so we elected to have a evidence-based program designation. And there's a set of standards that, that programs will need to meet in order to receive this particular designation. And our hope was several things. One is we think it will continue to advance the interest in doing research on a program level. And that does several things. One, doing research on a program level not only helps you improve your program, but it also helps give referring professionals, parents, families, government officials, lawmakers, others. It gives them the evidence, the understanding of the work that we do, of its effectiveness and its social role. And so that's very helpful for a referral source to be able to say, look, this is the best program for this particular issue or concern, and to have data behind that. That's very helpful as well. So we know it'll improve our programs by doing the research internally and using it to continue to improve, but we also know that it'll help us tell our story to others about the work we do and its importance. And so the research initiative was really set up for that purpose. However, we've only had a handful of programs that have really been putting in the bulk of the data. We've got a lot of them that are kind of working out the processes. We've done our best to try and make it a very easy entry point for people who want to do research through our work with the University of New Hampshire and a software product called Outcome Tools. The process is very simple and very inexpensive for all of our programs to be able to participate. So as they're coming on board, we wanted to set up this designation and to actually help accelerate that work, to give people a bar to reach, a standard to reach, and so that once they get involved and engaged in research, they'll continue to do it until they can reach this particular standard. The standard will require that they actually can show across time that they have improvements, that there's measured improvements, and therefore their program is effective. And so by having that designation, we hope to accelerate the work. The other thing that it does by having that sort of designation for our member programs is it also tells the world that we are very interested in research. We're very interested in outcomes and in knowing how we can improve our programs, how we can ensure that we're offering the kind of work and at a program level that is effective, and doing the kinds of things that moms and dads and others and referring professionals are hoping that we are doing, and we'll have the evidence behind it. So it tells everyone that we're interested in that. We're interested in outcomes, and that's important.
Okay, well, you know, one of the questions I think that comes up, and I'm sure you discussed this, is NASAP and these programs are well known for the flexibility, for unique programming, experimentation, and that type of thing. But evidence-based programs would seem to be, with that originality, there'd also seem to be some sort of tension with an evidence-based program, because if you're an EBP, you're doing something that has been proven before, numerous times. And wouldn't that dampen a little bit the tendency to experiment, because something that's new and different wouldn't get that designation? Is there a tension in that, or how does that balance?
Now, that's a great question, Lon. What we're talking about is not a program inside a program. Evidence-based programming may be a particular kind of intervention that I use inside of a program that's got some evidence behind it that may have been used in multiple different programs. This is actually a designation for your program as a whole. And so as you do the research and the outcomes for your program as a whole, it will allow you, again, to be able to, you know, as you do it across time, be able to use that data to continually to tweak and improve and make course corrections as you need to internally. You'll be able to experiment with your own programming and see, look, this is helpful, this is not, you know, we got to do more of this, less of that. It actually will help us refine our own programs individually and uniquely, how they are set up to move forward. The data that we're collecting as an association will be collected in a collective, but that data also is available to every program individually to make their own program improvements. But this isn't evidence-based programming, which is really there's lots of different therapy models, interventions that are actually evidence-based that have been standardized that people plug into their programs. This is actually your program as an entity.
Okay, so it sounds then that it would help encourage them to find better ways to use or different situations to use a program or an approach that does have the evidence behind it, but you can use it in new and different ways, and it encourages that?
Yeah, we hope that it encourages creativity and innovation. We want to continue to do that, so we're not about trying to standardize everyone. We think one nice thing about the association is we feel that, you know, the unique elements of every program we want to keep and retain. For one child may be served really well in Anasazi Foundation, but another child may be served better here or in another circumstance or situation. Our hope is that people will actually be able to see that. They'll be able to see who's best served by who, and to be able to, you know, have that kind of evidence in front of them, but not to standardize the work that we're doing across the board. We like people keeping their unique elements, what's unique to that program, and the populations that they serve. So now, that doesn't mean that any program couldn't use an evidence-based practice inside their program, and we hope that people will pull from that, because that will be helpful, but only where it fits inside of the unique competencies of that particular program.
Okay, well, that sounds very good. Excited. Now, Mike, be sure to keep us appraised as how it's doing and what's happening, and we'll talk to you later on and see how this is doing. And this is Lon Woodbury with the Woodbury Report. Been talking to Mike Merchant, the president of the National Association of Therapeutic Schools and Programs.
Go ahead.
Hey, Lon, I just heard it shut off. Well, that was interesting. You know, I think evidence-based approaches are great, and I am all for the research that they're doing, and I think it's wonderful that they're doing that, because obviously making these decisions is a big investment, and parents want to make sure that they have as much information as possible to hopefully get the get it down the right track. But, you know, one thing I do want to just really quickly say is a funny little 30-second story, but I do recall a man I used to work for years ago, after a child had left his program and unfortunately had struggled significantly, 15 years later came through with his wife and two kids on the way to Disneyland, and he said had they taken the poll a year after the kid left, they would have said maybe he wasn't a success. But 15 years later, he was a father with three kids on his way to Disneyland and a teacher in a middle school. So I think research is awesome, and I'm really all for it. We know that life can take many paths. So it can provide some level of security, and I just hope that, you know, hope that they do complete what they're going to try to do there at NATSAP.
Well, antidotes is that is it sort of provides the life or the juice in behind the statistics, because statistics are important to show what's happening and your outcomes and evidence based. But the antidotes is where you see, yes, real live people are being affected. It's just not a statistic. And I think all of us have heard stories and seen stories or lived stories like that. One, I ran into a few students that I'd moved in when I was a business director, and they're doing way great. And I would have a lot of them I wouldn't have thought they were going to.
Yeah, you just never know.
Okay, we're just about wrapped up. I'm getting the high sign that we're ending up. This is Lon Woodbury, and we've been talking about some of the news about schools and programs, what's happening amongst private parent choice residential programs for struggling teens. And Liz, thank you for joining. This has been good.